This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Coquitlam peoples.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is July 15th, 2021, and this is episode 248.
I'm Scott Delonderbohm.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, we're just going to spitball on our hopes and our dreams for election 44, the one that it's probably going to happen. We all think it's going to happen, and we're going to make it happen by continuing to talk about it. First, as always, thank you to the 103 amazing people who give us money every month to just talk about politics. You're great, and if you want to be great like them, go to patreon.com/politicoast. Let's just jump into our election wish list, the main thing we're going to talk about today. It's summer. Not a lot of politics is happening, except in the Green Party, where they're continuing to implode, but we'll come back to that. So we figured, let's just dig into what we hope and what we think could happen in this election that seems inevitable at this point. Is it inevitable? Let's start there, maybe.
Until Trudeau goes to the new Governor General and requests the Parliament get dissolved and the writs be drawn up, no, it's not inevitable. Certainly everything seems to be trending in that direction, and I don't know, unless something worse than the blackface photos comes out in the next couple of weeks, I think it's pretty likely they're going to be going for it.
Yeah, if we saw a Delta variant spike the way America and Britain and a number of countries are worryingly seeing, and Canada has not seen yet, and maybe because we've gotten enough vaccines and we just happen to do
it. I'm not sure if that's necessarily the case, because the Netherlands hit something like a doubling or tripling of their case numbers, of their daily case numbers, in a couple of days, and they are not far off our vaccination rates.
Yeah.
Just worrying.
So, yeah. Let's all stay nervous about that. Keep wearing your masks, people. And yeah, keep being good. There's still lots we can do. But presuming that doesn't happen, I think that's the biggest thing that could delay an election. But even that may only delay it 2 or 3 months at this point. Who knows? We're heading to the polls, it feels like. We talked last week about the number of campaign announcements that each party leader was making.
I think we teased what was the soon-to-be-announced Trudeau announcement last week. And yeah, that turned out to be big new SkyTrain line funding. So that they're definitely pretty happy to sprinkle around a lot of money.
Yeah, and it's something that it's much easier to do when you're in government and you can have ministers go there with checks in hand and do a formal announcement, as opposed to when you're opposition and you can say vaguely, we will try to do this.
Yeah, O'Toole actually beat Trudeau to the punch on promising to fund the Surrey SkyTrain extension, but because he's not in government, that kind of landed with a bit of a thud. I'm sure people in the riding paid attention to it, but it did not quite get the same coverage that it does when the Prime Minister makes the announcement.
And Trudeau went one further in promising to fund the UBC extension of the Arbutus line business case, or at least part of the business case, which is a necessary step, but I think the headline oversold it a bit for many transit enthusiast listeners here in Metro Vancouver. It's still a good step. I still want to see that train line built. But yeah, so it's easy to do the announcements when you're a government. It's a bit tougher in opposition, but we are seeing, like you said, the Conservatives and the NDP in particular are making announcements. Let's maybe just go through the parties then and try and figure out what would be their ideal campaign from each of our perspectives. Like, we each have our bias towards who we would want to win and how we would want them to win, but let's try and treat this sincerely for what we think would be good for that party and the country to do, if that makes sense. We've generally tried to do that in the past, I think. Try to be fair. Let's start with the Liberals. What kind of campaign do we need to see them run to feel good about the Trudeau brand once again? How do we get back to sunny ways?
The sunny ways ship has sailed. You don't spend 6 years in government without accumulating enough baggage that you can't do the same look how great we are, this shiny new party sort of thing that happens in 2015. That's just not in the charts. So instead, they have to do the it's important for continuity, a strong, stable, liberal majority government is needed, all of that stuff. And they're probably going to be pretty happy to, if the campaign stays pretty low key, they get to ride out their current polling and nothing changes too much. If the Liberals end with where the polls are right now, I think they'd be pretty happy.
Yeah, I generally think that the Liberals know how to campaign, and I generally like how their style of campaigning. It's the rhetorical progressivism that appeals to me, at least a base level. I can quibble over whether their policies are strong enough for what I would want to see, but the vocally, their hearts feel like they're in the place where I want them to be. And so when I watch Liberals campaign, I go, I could almost buy into that. I could almost maybe buy into that. And it's just, it's the after. It's the keeping the promises that is always the frustrating bit for me. And we've seen that through the past parliaments where we go, there's a lot of half-checked boxes. There's some like electoral reform that they just gave up entirely. They did deliver cannabis legalization, but that's such a long time ago now. It's like basically forgotten. And now it's basically just a provincial implementation issue. So I don't know exactly how they rebuild that trust, but I guess when you're government, you have more leverage there than others.
I'm actually not sure they have a trust problem, at least not on that. I think they have the general accumulated liberal skeeziness with when it comes to double dealing with friends and whatnot and being a little too cozy with certain liberal aligned groups, whether they be large Quebec-based engineering firms or certain charity groups and whatnot. But I think in terms of the have you gotten what you were expecting from the Liberals, I don't get the sense that Canadians feel particularly let down by the Liberal government. People who pay a huge amount of attention to the platforms and everything or have a issue area they really care about, the very passionate electoral reform people, they're disappointed. I'm not sure that as a general kind of sentiment or kind of where the zeitgeist is, that Canadians overall feel like the Liberals are significantly different than they campaigned on in 2015. And to the extent they are, it's the stuff that I'm not sure Canadians are particularly tuned into. There's the big thing about how untransparent the Harper government was, how kind of run from the center and everything was based out of the PMO rather than being like a government of ministers sort of thing. And Trudeau has continued those trends and if anything is worse on all of those. But that is the thing that, you know, people who write for the Globe and Mail and people like us who talk about this on a podcast care about. But I don't get the sense that Canadians overall really feel like that is such a big deal for them.
I agree a lot. I think where I would push back is I think you're right that the scandals should weigh on them, but it's almost like they've had 8-10 months of relatively unscathed, scandal-free governing pretty much since prorogation in August last year. And somehow that actually did clear away the larger scandal or the last major scandal, the We Charity stuff. There's some like stuff around the Chinese lab, there's some stuff around the Winnipeg lab and some of their obfuscating on documents, but I don't think those have large resonance like you're saying. I think people like you're saying are coming out mostly out of the pandemic pretty well. Like definitely not everyone, but for the middle class and those working hard to join it, they're doing not bad. Like it's that K-shaped recovery where a lot of people are doing actually much better because they didn't go traveling and their expenses got cut. And so they actually put more money in the bank and were able to actually get a bigger home on the low interest rates. And then there's another chunk who probably vote less, frankly, unfortunately, who are getting priced out of housing and who may be in still precarious work and are having issues still. But Trudeau doesn't necessarily need those votes. And even there's some sympathy because Trudeau tried and he put in CERB and all of those programs.
Yeah, there's plenty we can quibble about on the pandemic with how the Liberals handled it. But a lot of that was on the implementation of the countermeasures to the virus spreading or getting into the country. But once it got started, they were pretty on the ball with a lot of the supports on that stuff. And generally think Canadians feel like they were supported through the pandemic by the federal government to the extent that there were problems. It mostly fell on the premiers who took the brunt of the blame on that. And that even if Trudeau didn't get everything right, he had his heart in the right place, was seen to care about this stuff. So I just don't think there's going to be any real downside or harm to the Liberals on the pandemic stuff.
Well, and the other big advantage for the Liberals, of course, is weak and divided opposition.
Yeah, actually, that's where they may have some challenges, is their typical playbook is scare a bunch of the Liberal NDP voters into voting Liberal to stop the Conservatives. But when the Conservatives are sitting at 22% or something, that gets really hard to make the case that NDP voters need to grit their teeth and go for the Liberals. So that does upset their traditional election framework. So yeah, I think that kind of more or less covers off the Liberals. I have some opinions on what policy areas I'd like to see discussed and things I think the Trudeau government hasn't been particularly attentive to in terms of files, but let's face it, we're probably not going to be getting that in the election. If everyone pay attention,
I'm curious, what would be your wish list Trudeau platform, like top two or three?
Oof. Well, these aren't so much necessarily like Liberal policies I really want to see, although I could think of some more kind of general policy discussions I want to see happen. And Canada basically hasn't had anything approaching a coherent foreign policy in years, and it would be really nice to have at least some sense of where the different parties stand on that and what that means, particularly as I think international politics have gotten both a lot more uncertain and a lot more impactful than they were, say, 10 years ago or so. But I don't really see a huge amount of signs that the Liberals or anyone else is really chomping at the bit to talk about that sort of thing. Maybe the Conservatives are a bit.
No one wants to campaign on that, which is understandable, but yeah, frustrating.
Yeah, that fits in the giant mess that is government procurement, stuff like that. But those are issues I care quite a bit about, but I don't get the sense any party really wants to dig into them.
I'd be interested in seeing some substantive commitments on reconciliation from the Trudeau government. We've seen a lot of the performative promises and the cringeworthy take a knee photos, which it's you're in charge, you're apologizing nonstop. That's all great. What are you going to do? And the Liberals can take some credit on moving on boil water advisories, though there are still a lot outstanding. There's like little wins here and there.
Yeah, the thing is they've
talked in the past about a broader new framework for working with nation to nation, but like where's the plan to repeal the Indian Act? Give me the 5-10 year plan to get there, because it can't be done overnight, but it needs to happen.
That is a giant potential giant policy area discussion, and from what I gather, Indigenous nations aren't even unified on, or Indigenous people on how they go about it. I think there's a pretty strong sense that the Trudeau Senior proposal from several decades back.
Oh yeah, the white paper would be a bad policy.
Yeah, that's not the way they want to go about it. But beyond that, there hardly seems to be a consensus either in the political parties or among Indigenous groups on how exactly to go about that. And that's the sort of thing that's going to take years of discussion to try and figure out.
Yeah.
It's not likely to...
I'm suggesting he can bring forward a, we're going to start consultations working towards this end. Here's how those will look. Maybe it's an independent inquiry or a commission to study it and bring forward the commission, the recommendations, and he commits to implementing those. Something like that would be realistic, I think, rather than just saying, here's the new nation-to-nation bill, and we're just going to pass it. That would go over badly. But yeah.
Yeah, and there's the easy stuff that I think everyone can agree on, the ending the boil water advisories is the quintessential example there. But a lot of the kind of messy governance systems questions just really thorny, and there isn't going to be easy answers, and there certainly isn't going to be answers that can be boiled down to a campaign spot or a line in a stump speech.
I think reconciliation is definitely going to be on the agenda for the election, though, so each party will do well to come up with a good response, a strong... It doesn't need to be specific changes that will be made overnight, but how will you govern differently to fix the mistakes and the evils of the past and present? And I'll be watching all the parties for that, at least. I don't know, maybe the Liberals can also promise some more transit announcement. They've done some of that already, so that was good to see. But let's change gears to the opposition now. The Conservatives, as mentioned, are in a very bad spot. And it's weird in many ways because, like, you like Aaron O'Toole and how he ran his leadership. And I was impressed.
To be honest, I liked him more in the Aaron O'Toole that wasn't in the 2019-2020 leadership race, but the more 2017 Aaron O'Toole.
Sure. I was going to say that's actually the Aaron O'Toole.
Yeah. That's more the O'Toole we're actually starting to see post leadership.
But he has this party, this caucus, that seems, is it ungovernable? Are they?
It's not ungovernable because Stephen Harper managed to govern it. But that may just mean that Stephen Harper had more political talent than most people gave him credit for. Just a lot of it was focused on holding that coalition together. But in terms of can anyone come in and easily govern it? No, it's a huge challenge. And I think that's a lot of the kind of things that have generally made politics somewhat more contentious and difficult to manage in the past half decade or so have only intensified those challenges. Identity lines are drawn harder. Social media kind of reinforces group polarization, that's the word I'm looking for, group polarization, where as groups get together and talk amongst each other more and more, they naturally tend to move towards the extremes, and that happens with pretty much every group. It's just a part of human psychology, and that has made doing coalitional parties that much harder, because you have your small business Ontario Tories and your oil patch wetsit sympathetic Alberta populists, and trying to keep them together is just, I think, structurally more challenging than it was in 2006.
Yeah, I definitely think it's not just a matter of the Conservatives don't have a leader as effective as Harper today, but that things have changed enough politically that I don't even know if he could keep this party together right now. And that's neither here nor there, because they have Aaron O'Toole and they have this caucus. And when I look at this election, I imagine a Conservative Party competing in an election and competing effectively and for the good of the country. I could see Aaron O'Toole running a campaign that I'm interested in. I wouldn't vote for it, but it would be one that I would not be disgusted by, for example, where he does talk up a climate plan, and we went both ways on the plan they announced, but there is some good stuff in there relative to the almost nothing that Scheer presented and the conservatives had in the past. And he has a concern for social issues that is on the right side of history, I like to think. How he navigates a party that seems or a caucus that's divided down the middle on some social issues is been interesting to watch, because it's one of the harsh, most difficult lines. Like the conversion therapy votes, for example, the Conservative Party split almost roughly down the middle, half in favor of the bill, half against the bill as it stood. And the narrative coming out of the Conservatives was the social conservative one. Their talking points were the Conservative talking points. You didn't hear much from, there were one or two Conservatives who were in favor of the bill did stand up and speak specifically, gave their speeches in favor of it. But the ones who were against it dominated the headlines, both when they said embarrassing things about lesbian activity, but also just their framing of the definition is the issue. And there was a lack of leadership there.
Yeah, it's always tough on the issues that split the party. And that's certainly one that there, I don't think there is a uniform consensus on. And just knowing conservatives, there's probably a not insignificant chunk of the people who ended up voting against who that definition question was actually a real concern and not just pretextual. But yeah, it's a tough go for any Tory leader in that spot. And Harper managed it by basically ruthlessly trying to shut down any questions on any of the social conservative stuff. Basically, as soon as the, was it 2006? I guess we, yeah, 2006 same-sex marriage vote, which pretty decisively put an end to that question. After that, which was a campaign promise to hold an open vote or a free vote on that. But once that was done, yeah, it was pretty much solidly clamped down on afterwards. And I don't think Scheer particularly had the inclination to do it, although a bunch of his advisors and staffers probably realized that strategically it was a good thing to do. I think O'Toole probably leans more in the Harper camp on that, but doesn't necessarily have as solid a fate or solid a grip on the party to actually pull that off effectively. And that's going to be a huge challenge for sure in the campaign.
And so the campaign they have to run is one where they're already on the defensive for these reasons. They need to really somehow switch the narrative to try to bring out the things people don't like about the Liberals, the things we talked about in terms of the scandals. The spending is one they're going to go back to. The Liberals are spend tax. But that's also shifted a lot politically in terms of what people are okay with versus where we were 10, 15 years ago.
Even 2 years ago. And I think that's going to be real key, because there's definitely a part of the party that wants to pull in that direction. It's a very comfortable spot for conservatives to be talking in, but the fact is, Canadians just don't think that the middle of a pandemic was the time to be stingy with the spending, and that sentiment is going to continue until they're either hit with the big tax bill or something changes in the general status quo, or something starts to interfere with the government's ability to actually do stuff for fiscal reasons. And that means that's probably not going to be particularly resonant for people who weren't already going to vote conservative. And the where do you get the next 10% of your vote is a real big question for them right now. And I'm not necessarily sure there's an easy answer. That they can't do anything in Alberta to really help them that much in terms of actual seat counts. They're down quite a bit from the last election.
But they also ran the table in the last election. So yeah, they stood to burn some votes there. They just haven't picked them up anywhere else for it.
They were pulling massive majorities in a lot of spots in the prairies, and that just doesn't help them too much in terms of seat count. So that's going to be a challenge for them. I think O'Toole started to move in the right direction in terms of trying to appeal to a more Eastern Canada sentiments on that sort of thing, but it's so far seems to mostly have the effect of annoying the Alberta component of the party rather than really being successful in appealing to the 905.
Yeah. So it's a real tough go if you're Aaron O'Toole these days. I have no sympathy or no desire to do that job.
Yeah, leader of that coalition is a tough one, and it does seem very just structurally difficult to arrange the typical conservative coalition in a way that's actually translates into electoral victory. The other thing I'm going to be keeping an eye out for is if we get any sense from the campaign announcements, the platform, any of that sort of stuff, whatever stump speech O'Toole ends up running with in the election, is the answer to the question that I've raised quite a few times in past episodes on what does it mean to be a conservative in 2020? Because the 1980s through 2010, 2015 answer to that question doesn't really seem to be working anymore, and it's just there, but doesn't serve to help them really address the problems that face Canadians right now or even speak to Canadians' worries. And what the new form that kind of right of center politics takes in Canada is very much an open question, and I'm going to be interested in seeing if they actually have an answer to that question. We got a little bit of that hinted at in, it was probably only the first 6 months of O'Toole's time as the leader, when you could see he was experimenting with presenting a more labor-friendly version of the Conservatives, really going for the kind of blue-collar appeal on that, which I could see them trying to pick up and run with again in the election. Yeah, it's very much an open question, and one I hope we at least get some indications on.
I'm also going to be looking for specific policy proposals. Like, we talked in the BC 2020 election about the emptiness or the weirdness of the BC Liberal platform, where the biggest pledge was to eliminate a PST holiday, which seemed to come out of nowhere and baffled everyone no one really thought that, no one was asking for that. No one, people would have appreciated it, I'm sure, but didn't really catch on. So what are the ideas the Conservatives can present? What are they going to do around affordability and housing in a way that, like, the Liberals haven't been doing? Because the Liberals have put forward a national housing strategy with a bit of money going into that, but that's not, I think, been widely publicized or delivering results yet. Housing's a very slow challenge, but what will the Conservatives do there, if anything? And will that break from kind of the traditional free market approach? What will they do on cell phone and wireless bills? What will they do on internet regulation? Some of these questions the Liberals have raised in ham-fisted ways, but you can disagree with how the Liberals have tried to answer it, but that doesn't mean there's not problems there that need some kind of intervention.
Yeah, on the housing front, I see them actually going for a very free market approach, because there is a generally conservative solution to a lot of the housing issues. The challenge is those are mostly doable at the provincial and local level. What sort of ways that can translate into actual on-the-ground policy impacts is an interesting question. There's room for some creative thinking on that for sure. Pierre Poilievre has been talking up that issue for a while now, so we may be seeing some indications on where they land on that. But that last step of how do you translate a federal government the federal government's legislative powers into that is something that's not entirely clear, and they'll need to have an answer for.
So yeah, there's lots of room for the Conservatives to do more. they just have to escape their own shadow and Justin Trudeau's shadow at the same time.
Yeah. The other thing I'll say, and something I'm hoping that the Conservatives are the ones who bring this up, because I think they're probably the most likely to, is very much that kind of foreign policy, security sort of question. I think it's fairly clear at this point that the relationship Canada and other Western countries have with a increasingly powerful China is going to be the big geopolitical question of the next several decades. And the Canadian electorate's never really been, or Canadian elections have never really been one, a place to really dive into these issues. It is nevertheless a very important question. And one, I think the Conservatives are probably more willing than the other parties to really dive into. And I hope that gets discussed a lot more in the coming election.
The third largest party in the House of Commons is still the Bloc Québécois. I can't say that I know anything that the Bloc has accomplished in the last parliament.
They got the parliament to pass that motion, basically affirming, I'm going to forget the bill number here, is it Bill 22? The most recent Quebec language / constitutional changes bill, the one that declared, is it Quebec was a nation? I'm blaming it on the details a bit, but they managed to pull the rest of the Commons along with them on that. So that is something they've probably
extracted. Oh, I thought that bill was largely a provincial matter.
Yeah, but they got all the Commons to basically effectively stake out a position of support on kind of the general principles of it. In terms of actual legislative accomplishments beyond that, it's probably mostly stuff they managed to get in concessions out of the Liberals that we would have to have dived into a lot of the specific bills to really have a better sense of.
Yeah.
That's going to be their promise going forward, too.
I mean, yeah, neither of us are in the weeds in Québécois politics, which are very unique and different. And all I can say about the Bloc is they came back. They were almost eliminated a few elections ago, and they're back in a sizable way. They seem to still enjoy support in Quebec. I guess they just need to keep doing what they're doing. Like, they have something like 30 or so seats. No, they have 32 seats right now. They're ahead of the NDP by 8. They could, like, there's 75 seats in Quebec, I think, offhand. So they could stand to gain more, but, like, their ceiling isn't huge for where they can go. They're in a minority parliament situation. It's their best case scenario right now. They just need to leverage it for Quebec like they've been doing. So, I don't know. Yves-François Blanchet seems popular still in Quebec, so I guess he can just keep banging the Quebec drum and it'll work for him.
Yeah,
I hope they get less racist, but
the basic value proposition of the Bloc has not changed in years. It's going to be that. They're going to basically continue to run on that. That's still going to be their, what they want to get out of it. I don't know. This may be some recent change or like issue that has come up that's very Quebec specific. And if my French wasn't extremely rusty, I took the time to actually read Quebec media, I might have a better example or better sense of. But I think by and large, the general positioning of the Bloc is the same as it's always been.
Well, let's talk about the more interesting party, the NDP. What can we say about the NDP? Jagmeet Singh is enjoying like a wave of positive press in terms of his as a TikTok star, as the most popular leader for people under 30. A lot of things that are good to see if you want to have your party do well, but they're also not quite the kinds of things you need, because there's always that perpetual young people don't vote as much issue. You can have every Gen Z and millennial voting for you, but there aren't as many who actually turn up to the polls, even though there are a lot more millennials than many other generations. they're still floating around 18-19% in the polls, sometimes up to 20. There's like a path that seriously exists, though it still might be a remote chance for the NDP to actually overtake the Conservatives, which would be wild. I don't think we've ever seen the Conservatives not be first or second in history.
You do have the 93 election where the Bloc was the official opposition party and the Conservatives were reduced to 2 seats.
And Reform took a few others in there. That was a weird one.
That was a weird election. But in terms of the post-uniting Conservative Party, yeah, it would be unprecedented, or even the pre-1993 election.
Mm-hmm. So I think Singh is poised to do well. It feels in many ways like he could pull off a 2011-style NDP campaign where things hit an inflection point and just jump. Although I was thinking back to that campaign, and I remember when that started, people were basically looking at Jack Layton and thinking, that man is literally dying before us. He was walking around with a cane. He had just come off his first bout with cancer and was looking sickly, and it was sad to watch in many ways. But he's, no, I have enough energy to do this. And then like halfway through the campaign, he started picking up a little momentum in Quebec and then had a like ace performance in the debates that just rocketed him to official opposition. I don't know if the cards will fall right for Singh to follow that kind of trajectory, especially like he needs to break through in Quebec to get that good, but he could still get the NDP into the 40s in seats with English Canada.
It's going to be tough. Like, they're competing with the Liberals on that, with a reduced Conservative Party, at least going in, because there's always the chance that the election could change quite a bit. It's worth remembering that Trudeau was in third place at the start of 2015. So things can always change in election, but presuming the general arrangement of party support stays roughly constant throughout the majority of the campaign, it's going to be somewhat tough, I think, for the NDP to really gain, because without having to worry too much about his right flank, the Liberals can really move in and try and eat the NDP's lunch. And particularly in this climate where spending just isn't the source of political concern it used to be, there is very little incentive for the Liberals not to promise a lot. And that leaves the NDP with not a huge amount of room to maneuver before they get squeezed out or have to move into a significantly more radical position that probably is going to put them offside with a lot of the more general, accessible, but not committed NDP voters.
So you alluded to it when we were talking about the Liberal parties as a focus, that the typical Liberal strategy involves appeal to strategic voting at some point. Look, you can't go, we know you might want to go NDP, but you got to vote for us to keep away the Conservatives. And with the Conservatives so weak, like you're saying, they have to either swing harder left to try to take the NDP votes or present themselves as the more credible alternative to deliver on those results. The NDP at this point can be freer to not have to worry about arguing over strategic voting. They can say, hey, this is the election, you can vote your conscience. And Trudeau is the guy who did blackface if they want to go there, or he's the guy you can't trust, or he only did, what's the messaging they're using right now? He only did what he did because we were there. And whether the facts hold that up don't really matter. It's politics. You can just say things, and as long as they're believable.
Yeah, I don't know.
They get people mad.
That line of argument doesn't strike me as one that's going to be particularly successful. The Liberals are in government. They wear the success or the failures on what happens. Same reason why in a formal coalition arrangement, the junior partner never gets any credit for what gets passed. The same thing applies even more when there's not a formal arrangement. And it looks, trying to find the right word here, looks cheap, hey, don't forget about me kind of attitude to that. And I think telling the voters that, yeah, the Liberals did all of those things, but isn't going to be as convincing as I think a lot of NDP partisans want to believe it will be.
I did really love the brazen crassness of claiming credit for Bill 12, the Net Zero Accountability Act, and even naming the bill as though the NDP introduced it on their Twitter and said, if it weren't for us, this government bill that was largely passed as written by them, like we tweaked it a little, maybe, it wouldn't have passed. It's no, I'm pretty sure the Liberals would have passed a like toothless Net Zero Accountability Act. Like, shouldn't the NDP want better than net zero as well? Like, actually reduce emissions and not just try to offset them? But that's getting into a deeper thing. But it clearly pissed enough Liberals off, though. I saw a lot of Liberal MPs and staffers retweeting it critically on Twitter, just being like, how dare you? And it's, and they had very similar talking points. It was interesting to watch that reaction. The Liberals were not happy.
Yeah. I'll give the NDP credit for that. It forced the Liberals off message and into kind of taking an own goal on that.
They had to remind the public that they passed a bill they wrote.
Yeah. They could have handled that better
on Twitter. So, like, the strategy and the campaign tactics are working better than I've seen them in the lead up for the NDP to many elections. Like, the NDP is not a party that campaigns particularly well. Like, they got better at it under Jack Layton. Mulcair's campaign floundered because I think there was a lot of misreading of the public in that one. Singh's last campaign started from a very weak place, but managed to save the deck chairs and turn things around partway through.
More like, they still lost,
but
15
not as
seats.
Far. Yeah.
Let's not but pretend
he inherited a shell of a party.
Yeah, but still, going from 39 to 24 seats during an election where the Liberals got beat down from a majority to a minority is not a great showing. I get that the NDP partisans feel good about it because, man, were they ever depressed in 2016? But beyond that, like, just objectively speaking, it was not a great performance.
No, but that's not all on Singh. I blame Mulcair for a lot of that, for sticking around for so long after he lost his, after he got knifed by the party, which...
That didn't help, but so did Singh's decision to spend a year not in Parliament.
But he's been in Parliament for a while now, so things are quite different.
Yeah, I'm just saying, the period from between the point where he got the leadership and the point where he started to connect with and the NDP started to rebound was pretty long. And that's
so to just
partly on him.
To close off on the NDP for this coming election, this forthcoming presumed election, what I am hoping to see from the party this time is to, at some point, start switching your message from claiming credit for Liberal policies to start putting out some probably bolder NDP ones. They've talked about... There was an announcement this week about 1 million jobs, which actually just matches the Liberal and Conservative promises, only they'll do some additional labor market reforms.
Channeling Tim Hudak is not what I expected the NDP to do.
Hey, they're not promising to lay off 100,000 people to start. You have to fire some people to hire a lot more first. No, yeah, the 1 million jobs is a weird round number. At least it's more believable at the federal level than a provincial one. The NDP's also talked about their housing policy a couple times, so we've talked about that. There is broad public support when you ask for things like a wealth tax, for this childcare plan that the Liberals are working on, but the NDP can just say, yeah, we'll do that plus a little. They don't really need to do more. The Liberals are actually pretty ambitious on childcare. We'll do pharmacare. We'll do these things that you want to see, and we'll pay for them by not having any Canadians fly to space. We'll take their money before they can do that.
So the NDP would cancel the spaceport in Nova Scotia we talked about last week?
No, they nationalize it. Let every Canadian go to space.
Actually, on the topic of things we'd like to see in the platforms, I would actually be interested in seeing if any party has a space platform. I think it's unlikely we're going to get that, but space is increasingly important, and we need satellites for a lot of our territory where that's pretty much the only accessible way to communicate or see what's going on there. So it would be I would be very interested in seeing where the parties think we need to go in terms of developing in-nation space capabilities.
Maybe we'll get a throwaway line in one of the platforms about it, hopefully, if we're lucky. Anything else you want to add to the NDP?
Not really. Should we move on?
Let's just touch briefly on the Greens. We've talked about them in the past few weeks. The main thing I want to see is them to just somehow get over this civil war and campaign to actually run. I think the Greens are at serious risk right now of running like 30 people across the country.
I could see that.
Not fielding candidates in the majority of the ridings and being a joke.
Yeah. The big question, are they going to stop, you know, trying to light each other on fire long enough to actually put together a campaign? And part of the news this week was that they have defunded Annamie Paul's leadership. Part of the news this week is that they have defunded Annamie Paul's campaign for Toronto Centre.
Wild.
Yeah. So, like, on one hand, spending money in trying to win Toronto Centre just does not make any sense for the Green Party, because it is as safe a Liberal riding as possible. It is crazy to think that's a potential pickup seat. Nevertheless, you also do need to fund your leader's campaign.
Yeah, you want to see them do well as they can.
Yeah, and they're completely blown out in their riding is not good.
The council also allegedly moved to strip her membership this week as I'm unclear what the reasoning for this was, other than
because they
it was either a backup strategy in case the vote next week doesn't go their way and they're not able to force this leadership review, or it's a like she's sent us a cease and desist letter and we count that as she's suing the party and therefore she's disloyal and we should remove her membership. It's ugly. Don't do that to your leader on the eve of an election.
Yeah. So at this point, I think the big question for the Green Party isn't how many seats will they win, what will they campaign on? It's will they have a campaign?
I hope so. I hope so. But anyway, yeah, I'm much more in the enemy is facing deeply a bunch of systemic racism and toxic personalities who just hate her at this point camp than I was before. You hate to see it. Speaking of racism, let's talk about just briefly the People's Party, the Maverick Party, and any other fringe groups are out there. And I don't actually care about the People's Party. Max Bernier is a joke. I am, though, interested in the Maverick Party, because I think the reason we're seeing such plummeting for conservative support in Alberta is because some of the polls are picking up like 6, 7, 8, 9% support for others, which I think is parked votes for this. Maverick Party was the Wexit Party, and now it's Maverick there. I think it's Buffalo and Manitoba, and it's something else elsewhere. But it's the Alberta branch that's the strongest of the Wexiters. What do you make of it? We haven't done too much digging into this.
So the idea of splitting off the only landlocked provinces in the country is deeply stupid. So as like a general, what their proposition to Canadians or even the Canadians in the part of the province or part of the country they're contesting does not make any sense. In terms of what the actual impact on the election will be, I don't know. It's hard to say. Like, you often see parties where the leader's a little unpopular get a bunch of support parked with a nebulous other that, when push comes to shove and it's our fight against the hated Trudeau, that they all come home and this could end up being nothing. BC seen past elections where the BC Conservatives pulled reasonably well by their standards, only to completely collapse when the actual votes started coming in. It could be the same thing, or it could be a sign of like, deeper discontent. If it is the latter, it's going to be real tough to keep the Conservative Party together for the structural reasons we were talking about earlier, because if you can't even make modest nods to pulling in or broadening the appeal to central and eastern Canada without absolutely alienating a sizable enough chunk of the base that it starts to threaten seats in Alberta, it's going to be a real question of, is the Conservative Party even viable nationally? And how do you bridge that?
Do they just splinter and have a permanent electoral alliance between Reform 2.0 and Progressive Conservative 3 whatever, new version that represents the East? I just like this bit, though. I Googled Maverick Party to pull up their website, and the little info box on Google reads, "This isn't about right or left. This time it's personal," which I love as a mashup of former Green Party slogans and mantras with the tagline of it. I had to look this up. Jaws for the revenge. This time it's personal.
Was that the one? That's the one where the shark actually goes out and tries to kill like the specific protagonist from earlier movies, isn't it?
I didn't even know they made a fourth Jaws movie.
So I'm going to admit I've never seen a Jaws movie at all, even the original, which is by all accounts a classic, and I really should fill that spot in my movie-going repertoire. But I've heard the later sequels get pretty nuts.
Yeah. So just like the Maverick Party. Yeah, I'm sure they'll, if they do start to take off, they'll have their many Lake of Fire moments, but they're most likely to play it just a spoil for the Conservatives and maybe cost them a few seats in Calgary and Lethbridge. So we could see, like I saw one seat projection say the NDP could take 2 seats in Alberta, Edmonton, Strathcona, and Geesbrick, and the Liberals could take anywhere up to 8 or 9 seats potentially between Calgary and Edmonton. That starts to add up to a total.
Well, 9 seats, you're looking that's, at, what, a third of the seats in the province? How many are there, 27?
There's over 30
Over 30, okay. So not quite a third. But that's like at least a quarter of the seats, probably, they are potentially getting in that case. Which, admittedly, that's a high end. But that would be a bad spot for the Conservatives to be in when their base starts to crumble like that.
So, yeah, I'll be watching that. Anything else? Yeah, and I hope they just stay in the background, because I find that kind of wild populism very toxic to our political system. But here we are on the eve of election.
Yeah, 34 seats in Alberta, so yeah, 9 would be, that's 26, yeah, basically. Yeah, I don't really know much to say about it. It seems ridiculous from the outside, but there's always an undercurrent in a lot of places where you can't really get a sense of what's going on unless you actually have your ear to the ground, because what gets into the main media doesn't necessarily reflect kind of, you know, what people are talking about when they're hanging out with friends at the bar or whatever. Or,
well, and like, I know even social media people from Alberta where I can tell, like, the anger there at the political class is deep-seated, and like, it's fundamentally irrational at this point. It's just this like deep grievance politics that can't, there's no solution to it. They feel like Trudeau is doing them wrong. They don't feel like the Conservatives represent, under O'Toole, represent them for whatever reason. And it's, we need to be treated better in Confederation. It's like, how? What specifically are you looking for? And so Jason Kenney goes on about equalization referendums and pipelines, but like, those aren't, Trudeau bought a pipeline and it doesn't appease them. Others weren't going to go through. And so there's just this like disconnect from reality. The media system in Alberta doesn't help, because it's all being like 2 post media papers that have lost most of their journalists and now just repeat like columns about cancel culture, and it's not in a good state back home.
Yeah.
And I don't know the way out.
So like some of the grievances they, like, aren't entirely unreasonable. The political establishment in Ottawa will often move heaven and earth to try and keep, say, a Quebec industry going. When steel tariffs were brought in, it was practically a national emergency trying to get those turned around or stopped, and most of the steel production's in eastern Canada. The SNC-Lavalin thing, like, you don't have to look too hard at the history of the Liberal Party to find them going out of their way to to help businesses centered east of Kenora. And then they bought a pipeline. That's not nothing. There definitely doesn't seem to be the same willingness to fight is probably the way to think about it as there is there. And that does tend to be the sort of thing that breeds kind of resentment and a feeling of not getting a fair shake. And like, it's not entirely coming out of nowhere, but it's also just very hard to resolve on what going forward. And that, I think, is the bigger problem, is there is not an easy resolution to any of this, just in part because there's general structural factors that keep the Western provinces less able to exert their influence in Ottawa, most notably population size. An unequal Senate representation doesn't help either, especially now that the Senate's more willing to flex its muscles on stuff. And also the fact that their main industry very much has a limited lifespan, in the way that manufactured in Ontario or aircrafts from Bombardier don't. So it's all a mess. There's no easy resolution, and I get where some of that annoyance comes from, but there's really no way around it, and I think Alberta would be better off trying to be strategic about this rather than give it into the somewhat understandable emotions on this. But if we could solve that, but trying to solve regional conflict is a problem as old as Canada, and we're not going to be able to figure it out on this podcast, and nor do I think any of the leaders of any of the parties are going to be able to figure it out in the next couple months.
But they will try, because that's the point of an election. Oh, that or it's divide and conquer and just focus on the regions you need to get the seats. So we'll see what strategy each party decides to go with as we get into it.
So yeah, I guess we'll be keeping an eye out for the eventual writ drop that feels almost certain at this point. We did get a little bit of a hint at the timing when it was announced earlier this week that Mary Simon, the new Governor General, is going to be sworn in on the 26th of July. And like, technically they could go to the Chief Justice and have him issue a writ. It would be very bad for them to do so. I think that kind of puts a lower bound on how soon the election can be.
So we have at least a week to prepare, and potentially we'll even get the BC Day holiday.
Week and a half.
Then. Or maybe it'll be a BC Day election call. Just for us. Give our media something to do over the long weekend. In the meantime, I'm going to take a little vacation this weekend and get out of town for the first time in a while. You have any plans?
Not really. Just try and catch up on everything. This weekend will be two weeks since my second dose. I don't know, I should do something for it, but I've got no ideas on what that's going to be.
Lick all the door handles. I think that's the common idiom these days. Hopefully I'll get my second dose soon. Thank you all for listening. Good night.
And that has been Politicoast. Find links to everything we talked about at politicoast.ca. Support the show and get access to our Slack channel at patreon.com/politicoast. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikoff. Politicoast is a production of Legend Boot Media, and editing services are provided by CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. Wash your hands and stay home. Thanks for listening.